Under Putin's leadership, May 9th has become the most important day on the official Russian memory calendar. Known as Victory Day, May 9th commemorates victory over Nazi Germany in what is called the Great Patriotic War. It's a memory that Putin has used to fuel the growth of militarism in Russia, to justify the invasion of Ukraine, and to strengthen his own grip on power. But as Russians prepare for the 80th anniversary of Victory Day, we need to recognize how Russian families have been willing consumers and active participants in the commemoration of the Great Patriotic War. In many ways, the strength of the memory industry that's developed around the war appeals to the beliefs and values of Russian families. These beliefs and values are at once a primordial duty to honor and revere the generation that gave their lives in the war, and a product of cultural conditioning stretching back to Soviet times. How the memory of the Great Patriotic War in Putin's Russia appeals to family memory in this episode of Realms of Memory. Katya Haskins grew up in the Soviet Union and graduated from the prestigious Moscow State University at the very moment when dictatorship was giving way to democracy. From the celebration of the Great Patriotic War to the critical assessment of the Stalin era, she experienced firsthand the changing memories of the country's past. Now a professor of rhetoric and visual studies at Pennsylvania State University, Katya Haskins is the author of Remembering the War, Forgetting the Terror, Appeals to Family Memory in Putin's Russia. Katya, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you for having me.
So at the start of your book, you note that if you fell asleep in the 1990s in Russia and you woke up a decade later, it would seem like a completely different universe in terms of how Russians remember the past. So what do you mean by that? What changed over that period of time?
As I mentioned in the book, Rick, I grew up in the 70s and 80s in Russia. And by the time I was finishing high school and entering the university, the idea of the past, of the Soviet past, was under revision. And there was a lot of kind of turmoil and debate in public culture about the past, especially the memory of the so-called Great Patriotic War, World War II, and also about repressions, political repressions during Stalin's era, but also after that. And these public debates were, of course, allowed by Gorbachev's policy of perestroika and glasnost. And so floodgates were basically open to journalistic and other kinds of investigations, historical treatises about what really happened. Although this work, even though it was, allowed by the state, it was sanctioned by the state, it really kind of took on a life of its own. And so a lot of memory activism, a lot of historical revisionism happened in those late years, late 80s. And so by the time I was graduating from high school and entering the university, history was actually taken down from the roster of exam subjects because we usually had to take, if you were in the humanities, you had to write a composition, do a language exam, and history was usually one of them. And so they replaced history with a sort of Soviet version of sociology. And so this was a clear sign that there was no longer any official narrative about the Soviet past, that what we considered to be sacred truths about the war were no longer sacred. And so it was a very heady time to be alive. And I think, I'm very fortunate to have grown up during that era because it gave me a sense of freedom and intellectual curiosity that perhaps were not possible in the mainstream during earlier decades of the Soviet era. So I left the country in 91 and went on to study for graduate study in the United States. So my visits to Russia were not, you know, frequent during the 90s. The first time I returned was in 1996. And so I would say that the kind of the sense that the war and the sort of the triumphant memory of the war was slowly coming back was there because 1995, 96. So this was the years of Yeltsin's presidential campaign, and a lot of the older generation people, and especially veterans, were supporting the communist candidate Gennady Zyuganov. And Yeltsin was really, and or his political technologists, as we call them now, were really trying to capitalize on the sort of latent memories and good memories of the war to bring that electorate over to Yeltsin's side. So I guess it would be kind of wrong to say that the cult of the Great Patriotic War that I grew up as a child and during my early teenage years completely vanished. I think it kind of went into the background, receded into the background to give center stage to more sort of open, critical investigations of the past. But as an emotional attachment, it never really ceased to exist. So, and so the 96 or 95 resurrection of the cult in the form of lavish parades and various other celebrations of the anniversary of victory, of the Soviet victory in 1945, you know, gave a clear indication that this was not over. And so the cult was sort of being dusted off and brought out and used for political reasons. So, but it is really with Putin that we see much more effort on the part of the state and also private funds infused into the so-called memory industry. We see a lot more money being poured into film production and especially into sort of patriotic blockbusters. And so the film industry starts blossoming, and this form of basically propaganda becomes more mainstream. And there is a lot more emphasis on the so-called patriotic education. So people get involved in historic reenactment. There are more museums. So the sort of the spectacular aspect of the war becomes prominent again, but in a much less critical way than it was. There's definitely emphasis on gratitude and family, appeals to family memory of the war, appeals to family piety rather than memory, become prominent. And so you see this in a bunch of different venues. I was in Moscow in 2005 to do research at the what used to be called the Lenin Library. And across from the Kremlin is a famous department store that dates back to the early 20th century, GUM, State Department Store. And it's very posh, fancy place now with expensive boutiques. And I remember stumbling across this exhibit that displayed family mementos and letters from the front that belonged to the ancestors of boutique salespeople, right? So this was a very kind of, prosperous time. The oil and gas industry were making it possible for people to have a high standard of living. And so, you know, it was kind of interesting that in the place of conspicuous consumption, where foreign goods were sold and were very expensive, you would find this kind of pious display of family memory. So, and then of course, around Moscow, everywhere you looked were huge posters. And what I found interesting that they were starting to use enlarged photographs of actual people. So this was an appeal to kind of documentary veracity or factuality the war effort and kind of collective sacrifice and so forth. And of course, military parades in Red Square became again a fixture of V-Day celebrations, which V-Day is celebrated in Russia on May 9th. And so all of this was becoming louder, bigger, more ubiquitous, right? Stores started selling V-Day chocolates. And also, perhaps in a kind of surreptitious way, museum collections started bringing out huge canvases depicting Stalin during this time. So there was kind of a simultaneous amplification of the triumphal or triumphalist memory of the war with the resurrection of Stalin as a model national leader. And this was kind of very concerning. And I think this is when I really started thinking about how come, you know, we've arrived at this point. So this book is an effort to understand, to work through some of these questions. And it's certainly something that is linked to my own personal biography, because I consider myself, you know, a Soviet subject in the past, at least, but it has remained a huge part of me. And only thinking back about my education and the ways in which I was schooled has really given me some idea about or pushed me to try to understand how the rest of the country might have experienced this cult and how they're experiencing it now.
I mean, it's really easy to just conclude, well, this is an authoritarian state. This is all orchestrated from the top down. And you're looking at the parades covered on TV, and you can just dismiss it as a kind of indoctrination from above. And your point is, well, this, you miss out a lot of the story, that if you don't understand how there's a bottom-up process at work, and you describe this in terms of mythical logics of remembrance and mnemonic habituation. So these terms that are connected to the ways in which families remember, and the state taps into this, but families are part of this process. So if you have this excessive celebration of the Great Patriotic War and a lot of kind of frightening potential consequences because of this, families are part of that story. And sometimes unwittingly, the way they're drawn into it. So what are we missing if we just focus on this in a top-down way? Why do we need to take families into consideration? And what are these things, mythic logics of remembrance and mnemonic habituation? How do they work?
Yeah, this is kind of the theoretical maybe jargony part of the book, right? And because it is published by University Press, it is expected that you will be advancing the scholarly conversation about memory. The way I have arrived at it is part through observation. So my impetus was in part from just attending one of the parades of the so-called Immortal Regiment. And this is really kind of where I started thinking about the role of families in commemorating World War II, but also how this commemoration fed into the cult that's renovated under Putin. And part is the reading, my own education in memory studies that has led me to question kind of the ambivalent role of family memory in the 20th century, because we see, and of course, Maurice Altbach, who is considered to be the father of memory studies and the notion of collective memory, talks about family as the kind of the major primal framework of memory. He was one of the first people to maintain that we do not remember alone, that we need others and kind of structures and frameworks in which we can share memories. And so family is considered to be one of these primary frameworks. And if you're a family member, if you're a member of a family, your memories, both the familial experiences, but also national experiences, are likely to be in some ways framed, shaped, influenced by the way that you conceive of your obligation and your duty to your family. So it's not just an objective way to look back at historical facts. It's in a way a thanksgiving of a kind that you are expected to pay to your ancestors. And so it's a very kind of primordial thing almost, right? Because we know that things like funerary rites are really ancient, and so they involve thanksgiving to the ancestors. So the ancestors are considered to be a source of power and protection, right? If they go into the other world and so forth. So, but I think that even in secular societies, there is a sense that you owe something, you have a debt of gratitude to your family. And so this is kind of one part of the mythical logic where you may know something about the past from history books or critical investigations or whatever information you have access to. But at the same time, you're trying to figure out how your family fits into that bigger picture, bigger story. And your kind of natural tendency would be to remember your family in a better light, right? Or try to focus on the good that the family was involved in, right? So patriotic sacrifice in the war is a perfect story that you could attach yourself to. And so the familial obligation to remember and perhaps forget some of the dark spots, right, is a non-rational commitment, right? It's very hard to argue with it. And I think the term mythical logic was used by a sociologist, and I'm blanking his name, and so you'll have to edit this part. Jeffrey Olick was arguing about the way that mythical logics operate in terms of duties and taboos, right? While rational logics that deal with, you know, like state and political actors exploiting history and memory for their own ends, and they can dismiss or discard those memories if they're no longer useful or expedient and so forth. So, but duties and taboos is something you cannot argue with, right? You either do what they require or you go against some kind of collective presumption, right? So you transgress and you may have to pay the price for that transgression. So it's really kind of a pre-modern sense of what motivates people to remember in a certain way.
Yeah, and here so, this coming weekend, I have to fly down to Florida for the scattering of my uncle's ashes, and it's a duty to remember. I mean, it's a ritual.
Absolutely,
it's an example, I think, of the mythical logic of remembrance, and maybe when you go, you're sharing recollections of the person's life, the fond memories. And I don't know whether you consider, well, taboo, maybe you're not going to discuss things that might put the person in a bad light. Maybe you're going to edit out that, but it's a powerful source of remembering. It's not a textbook. It's not a class. It's not the state dictating. It's something you say it comes from within. That's the force of it. And it's this emotionally powerful thing. That again, you feel this duty to do this. You got to get in a plane, fly down, and spend a lot of time because this is something you're doing collectively together with your family members.
Absolutely, and if you come across some information by digging through family archive or, you know, discovering in your parents' papers something that indicates that they were not, you know, as stellar as you remember them, you are likely to leave that bit of information out of any kind of public remembrance, right? It would be considered indecorous to do so, right, at the very least. And so I think that that's kind of one of the pillars of this appeal to family memory, that there is a kind of emotional attachment and a sense of duty to remember your ancestor in a certain, usually positive way. And the second pillar of the mythical logic is what I call mnemonic habituation. And this really means that we remember through ways that we did not ourselves invent. So no memory, unless it's traumatic memory that you just can't help experiencing, is possible without some kind of story, without some kind of symbolic framework. And these stories and symbolic frameworks, images, narratives, plots, scenarios, is something that we learn through our exposure to a variety of cultural artifacts, like books and films and songs, museums, and so forth. So so these are the prompts, the texts, the artifacts that are part of our education, part of our bringing, and it's not necessarily all top down, right? And so these are the forms of memory that shape how we remember. And mnemonic habituation is a very gradual thing. And if you think about ritual as kind of a primary site of mnemonic habituation, ritual is something that we do not necessarily agree to participate in when we grow up. You know, there are family rituals, there are church rituals, right? There are rituals that we go through when we go to school. There are rituals that are involved in sporting events. And every time you're participating in a ritual, nobody's asking you whether you think it's a great idea. You're just there and you have to do it. And you behave in a certain bodily way, right? You put your hand on your heart and look toward the flag, or you perform in some other way, right? That is highly formalized, and the ritual happens over and over again. That's the thing about ritual. They are repetitive. They're cyclical. Sometimes the special calendar days that ritual, that call for a ritual. And so if you think about war commemoration, of course, V-Day celebrations are a primary place where this happens. And both in terms of like popular media, right? Airing of certain golden oldies on national television, but also family reunions and other gatherings that may be less formal, but nonetheless are repetitive and engage you in a very emotional, very bodily way. And so all of this is not something that we necessarily think about as an explicit form of address or rhetorical performance, but nonetheless, it accumulates right within us, and we gradually come to think of these ways of behaving with others as normal, as expected, as right. So there's a kind of a bodily habituation that happens even when you're watching war movies, right? You're not only you're emotionally involved in the story and have this kind of emotional connection to the characters, but if you watch this film or films like it on a regular basis every year, it becomes kind of part of your mnemonic makeup, so to speak, right? So these scenarios and ways of thinking about what happened in the war really shape your understanding of any details that may come from your family, for example, right? So kind of this creates a groove within you that you're reluctant to deviate from. So
if you're looking at how family memories work, this powerful personal emotional source, connection to the past that you're arguing that Putin is really successful in tapping into, but family memories don't work in a vacuum, right? They work within a larger cultural context. And a lot of your book is really explaining these different cultural contexts that shape families. So families are kind of unwittingly caught up in these larger cultural forces. And you note how movies are a part of this. So if people think about the Great Patriotic War in particular ways, it's because they've grown up with, generations of people have grown up exposed to these war movies. And, you know, we have a lot of war movies. I was trying to think of their parallels with the U.S. in this. And in some respects, there are. I mean, if you're looking at all the, you know, brothers and Band of Brothers
Saving Private
Masters,
Ryan.
Yeah, Saving Private Ryan, Masters of the Air. I mean, we could go on and on with video clips about the theme of gratitude towards our grandfathers or generation or beyond. So we see this in the U.S., but I don't think there's any parallel. The U.S. did not experience losing 20+ million people in a war. The extent to which this affects the Russian people, there's no parallel. I mean, you'd really have to go back to you'd have to go back to the Civil War, maybe for something like that. So the significance of war films is something on a totally different magnitude. And you stressed that growing up in the Soviet Union, you were personally exposed to these films. And they had typical scenarios and particular themes, and they just get imprinted on you. And a big one is the theme of sacrifice and how it's connected to the nation, right? So how does that work? So you mentioned that carries over into the Putin, to the post-Soviet era. So he picks up on this, the current period picks up on a lot of what was there. Doesn't invent it from scratch, but it adds some interesting twists to it. The way it works in terms of the DNA, for example, of the Russian people, or how it can function in terms of rehabilitating people, and how that can be a masking device. So, how do films about the war instill a certain idea in people about notions of sacrifice, connection to the nation? How does that carry over into the present, in the present era, and how is it updated and modified? And you have some really fascinating, really enjoyed reading about your analysis of these films like Stalingrad, The Dawns Here Are Quiet, The Penal Battalion. I have clips just queued up for all these things on YouTube, but I'm just not at the point where I can put these on screen, but I would love to. You can find these online easily. There's, what is it? The T-54 is another film that came up in another one of my interviews about the
T-34,
about the particular role of the tank. How do war films work in terms of Russian memory, your own experience, and how does that change, in the current era?
Yeah, it's quite a story. And, there's definitely an evolution to the war movie genre. And, you know, better scholars have done tremendous work on this topic. What I'm trying to do in this book is show there's a continuity in the scenario of patriotic self-sacrifice, despite the fact that there's a lot of variation, both in terms of artistry and sophistication and, you know, humanism of these films. You know, thinking about sort of the masterpieces of the war genre from the Soviet era that became internationally famous and acclaimed for their artistry and humanism, like Andrei Tarkovsky's Ivan's Childhood, from the mid-60s, Larisa Shepitko's The Ascent. You know, they show these normal, everyday people who have lost everything at the beginning of the war. They lost their families, and they are nonetheless acting selflessly to avenge their ancestors or avenge their family members whom they have lost. And this is a very kind of emotionally gripping tale. Beautifully shot, beautifully edited. So these stories are riveting. They're riveting, and there's not a whiff of propaganda in them. And so, like, stories like that implant the idea of self-sacrifice as a cultural norm, right? That is experienced in a very personal way. And of course, there was an earlier version of Dawn's Here Quiet, which I think is, for me, it's one of the central kind of texts of the war cult in the Soviet era and also Putin era, because it shows a battalion of women who are guarding a distant village in Karelia. There are anti-aircraft gunners, and there's one guy, Sergeant Major, who's kind of their boss, commander. And so they're not expected to be attacked. And however, they are called upon to defend not just their motherland, but defend everything in their past. They have lost husbands, they have lost families, and so forth. So they are rising to the occasion. They were not expected to fight, because even though women were fighting in the Red Army more than anywhere else during World War II, I think about 1 million women were fighting in the Red Army. There is still the sense that women are not expected to be soldiers, right? And so this is a movie about these young women, barely out of their teens, who are nonetheless giving their lives and doing it, some in very spectacular ways. There is a character, Zhenya Komikova, who is beautiful and talented, and she's also a bit sexually promiscuous. So there's this kind of appeal, sex appeal that goes along with it. They're shown in both versions, in the Soviet version and Putin era version, naked in the sauna. So it's, you know, making the war experience both heartbreaking and sexy is something that these films do really well. And so what was
fascinating too, so maybe the magnitude, the quantity of these films, very different from the U.S. I mean, I grew up with lots of World War II films, but nothing maybe in the same magnitude of what you're talking about. But you also talk about the calendar, the way they worked in terms of the calendar. That I couldn't really find any parallel. All I could think of was Christmas movies in the U.S. They're like, yeah, Christmas time. Oh, it's a Wonderful Life. But in the Soviet Union, and maybe Russia today, there are films, war films, that people expect to be on television. Right?
Yeah, and they're still very popular, and they're reruns of these classics around the time of V-Day, so leading up to the anniversary of Soviet victory, also around the time of the German invasion of the Soviet Union, June 22nd. So, and actually, that's kind of an interesting date, because it is very rarely acknowledged in public that, you know, World War II actually began when it began in September 1939. So in the sort of popular imagination in Russia, the beginning of the war is June 22nd. This is when Hitler violated the non-aggression pact and invaded the Soviet Union. So this kind of sort of exonerates the Soviet leaders from striking a deal with Hitler before the war for, and, you know, buying 2 years of relative stability domestically. Of course, the Soviet Union annexed the Baltics and had a brief, pretty devastating war with Finland leading up to the, 1941. So the 22nd of June is another date that is marked as a significant memory anniversary for the Great Patriotic War. And there are, heads of state lay wreaths on the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And of course, patriotic broadcasting happens as well. So yeah, these are very cyclical, repetitive, ritual-like acts of spectatorship that people engage in.
So yeah, that's an important point about the chronology that you talk about the commemoration of the war, whether it's in films or elsewhere. You got to be specific about the dates. You're not talking about 1939, fighting in Finland, or grabbing the Baltic states or partitioning Poland. That complicates that past. It's a pared down, shorter version of the war. It's easier to tell the story of the German attack and fighting that back, fighting that off. But when you look at it, so you have this. All of this baggage, cultural baggage of these war films and people that grow up with these and watch them during holidays and internalize these messages of patriotic sacrifice and their debt to the earlier generation. So that gets picked up again and gets recycled, almost like reruns of the past, right? But it gets updated for the needs of the present, right?
Yes.
And it works in some pretty innovative ways. So how does it get modified? First, it has to be relatable to people in the present who are used to video games and all the latest technology. They want an experience that's going to grab their attention because everything's about attention these days. And it's
absolutely
hard. It's hard to get that. So how do you do that? How do you make these work for a contemporary audience? And how do you add on dimensions to them that maybe weren't there before?
Right. Well, filmmakers have seized upon the Hollywood formula of a blockbuster, and there's a lot more spectacle. Thinking about films like Stalingrad that came in 2013 as the anniversary of the famous Battle of Stalingrad in 1943. And that film is basically a war spectacle that could be a video game. Very easily. It was shown in 3D and IMAX. So that gives you a sense of how important spectacle is. And at some point, if you're watching it in 3D, there's a scene where one of the characters, who is the commander of a small group of soldiers, is saving a young woman in this bombed out building in Stalingrad. And a stray bullet pierces the room in slow motion. So I don't know, if this is not a video game aesthetic, I don't know what is. And of course, also depictions of masculine prowess in slow ballet-like combat scenes, hand-to-hand combat, but also scenes like a group of men who are storming a German machine gun nest are set on fire. And so they appear as fiery angels against the black sky. So these are like highly, highly visually compelling scenes that, really do not communicate anything except how brave these men were, right? And how they did not care about dying, right? And of course, also there appeals to family gratitude. Stalingrad is specifically framed through a narrative of the son of the defenders of Stalingrad, and he's telling the story to a German teenager trapped under some rubble in Yokoshima. So, you know, there's a kind of a sense that, you know, Russian people have imbibed the sense of duty and helping, you know, others internationally, but also they are the ones who are descendants of people who saved the world from fascism. So it's you know, very heavily spectacular, but also kind of playing on the gratitude theme. And there's also kind of less, there are no gray tones, right? So these men are heroes. There's no doubt about it. They're all willing to get killed, and even call in an aerial bombardment of this house that are in, that they're in, so it would not fall into German hands. So there's this sort of unequivocal heroism that maybe not as evident in some of the old Soviet quieter war movies. These are loud, they are spectacular, they are definitely appealing to a new generation that has grown up on video games.
Well, what I thought was really fascinating is they give exposure to the repressions, right? So they're, on the one hand, it looks like they're shining a light on this difficult, dark past. They're talking about the people who were sent to the prison camps during the Stalin era. But you point out that that doesn't necessarily work in a critical way, there's a technique to these films which there allows them to incorporate this difficult past and erase it at the same time. So how does that work?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty neat trick that some of these films employ when they turn a victim of the state into a sacrificial hero. And interestingly enough, in Russian, the word жертва, victim, can also be a sacrifice. So there are two meanings of that word. And the plot lines of some of the post-Soviet films and series often show that, you know, the fact of repressions, that, you know, the state arrested or put to death a lot of people for no apparent reason. These stories are told in a way that makes the victims still defend the motherland, right? So with the new version of Dawn's Here Are Quiet, you have much, much more exposition of the background of some of these young women. One of them is a daughter of the Kulak family, so they were wealthy peasants or well-off peasants that were dispossessed and usually sent to Siberia. And so she's someone who joins this regiment and dies. Of course, everybody dies. And there's another woman who is very young. In fact, she lied about her age to join the military. And her mother, and she has these flashbacks of her mother being taken away by NKVD, the secret police, in the middle of the night, and other memories of her being in an orphanage, right? So this woman probably has very little understanding, or at least the movie shows her as this kind of innocent person who cannot really wrap her mind around what happened, what had happened to her mother. And yet she is volunteers for the front. She's willingly given her life for her motherland. So there's this sort of suggestion that, okay, these people were maltreated by their state, but nonetheless, they acted as heroes, they acted as citizens, and this was the most citizenly thing they did. And so we can remember them as heroes, along with other heroes, right? So there's a kind of retroactive exoneration that happens on kind of a symbolic level, right, on the story level, that disguises the extent, the reasons for repressions, and also their contemporary legacy, right? So it's kind of like wrapping this story neatly, giving it closure, saying, well, okay, so they suffered, but they were still heroes. And they chose to be heroes instead of being just victims. So I think that's a very dangerous, it's a dangerous trope of allowing victims to die and converting them into sacrificial heroes. And you see this actually in this very highly acclaimed series, The Penal Battalion, that does show sort of the brutality of the Soviet state and the mechanism that allowed a lot of the imprisoned citizens who were stripped of their citizen rights, whether they were actual criminals or they were Red Army soldiers who ended up in German captivity and then escaped. So regardless of the origin of their imprisonment, they are allowed to exonerate themselves by dying for the motherland. And these penal battalions are formed from former prisoners, and they're basically used as tank fodder. They're expendable. And so the series shows their humanity, their innate patriotism and desire to fight.
Yeah, so for people who are looking at prisoners, Russian prisoners who are given a chance to get out of jail to fight in Ukraine with a high chance that they're going to die, right? If you don't understand this cultural backdrop, you really can't fully understand the significance, the meaning of it. This doesn't come out of nowhere. This is really part, an integral part of popular culture, war as a means of redemption, self-sacrifice for the nation can kind of wash you of your past sins, and you can live on the glory of the nation afterwards. It's not just some despicable person gets out of jail.
Absolutely.
If he survives, goes back to the community, and who knows what happens afterwards.
Yeah, and you know, fast forward to 2022, the Russian patriarch came out and said that, yeah, if you are willingly giving your life for your motherland, regardless of what you have done in your past, you would be considered a sacrifice, and all your sins will be wiped away. So, and this comes from the highest priest in the country. So there's definitely this kind of sanctification of sacrifice. Sacrifice is to make something sacred.
So in a sense, it shows just how broad the memory of the Great Patriotic War can be, at least the official version. You can include everybody as long as the story ends up being the same and you're celebrating the nation. But there are other people who, you point out, felt uncomfortable with this triumphal narrative, and they felt like a lot of people were being left out of the story. They didn't want everything directed from above. And if you watch these May 9th Victory Day celebrations and you see these people carrying, holding pictures of their ancestors who fought in the war, you might not fully understand how this works in terms of the whole history of what you refer to, the history of the Immortal Regiment. How does this begin originally as a backlash to state-orchestrated memory and an effort to try to tell what they hope would be a broader story that would include the experiences of more people? And why does that just backfire and end up getting subverted?
Yeah, the story of the Immortal Regiment is one of, there are two aspects to it, I think. One is that, yes, there is a kind of bottom-up desire to remember family members in a particular way and to honor their experience in the war regardless of their role. So, the organizers of this initiative that started out in Siberia in the city of Tomsk, they were journalists And, you know, they just kind of decided that we don't want to do anything loud. We don't want tanks rattling. We don't want any slogans. We want something quiet. Yes, or flags or any kind of corporate logos. We want quiet remembrance, right? We want to acknowledge that our ancestors have died in the war, have lived through the war. So anyone, according to them, who has a relative who has lived through the war, it could be a child of war, an orphan, it could be a prisoner, you know, POW, it could be the survivor of the siege of Leningrad. So people who did not necessarily act in any kind of like frontline capacity, fighting with the, you know, with a weapon in their hands, but nonetheless lived through that ordeal, were worthy of celebration. And so you could, if you had access to your family archive and could find their photo, you could enlarge it and put it on a some kind of hard backing and carry it on a stick during V-Day celebrations, but it would be a civilian quiet procession. And so the initiative spread through Russia horizontally, and the folks who were organizing it were not really thinking of themselves as, you know, forming any kind of political party. They even were reluctant to incorporate in a kind of any legal fashion at first, because they felt that this would taint the kind of the authenticity of it, the bottom-up nature of it. But of course, because it was definitely an authentic, pious kind of celebration or memory, the state or state actors seized upon this as an opportunity to inject the sort of more triumphalist narrative into it. And so there was a copycat organization, the Immortal Regiment of Russia, that was registered in 2013, so like just a mere year after the ritual began. He registered Nikolai Zemtsov, who was a United Russia kind of basically person. He registered it in his name and as United as Immortal Regiment of Russia. And it became this highly funded, loud, mainstream, you know, compulsory really thing that overshadowed and muted the original tenor of the Immortal Regiment that was invented in Siberia in the provinces. And so, like, when I attended the 2015 parade of the Immortal Regiment in Moscow, it was already the one that the United Russia, Putin's party, took over. And, you know, I did not know that at the time, but it was kind of I felt suspicious about certain elements of it. So there were these well-muscled men, young men carrying Russian flags and Soviet flags. There were people who would start singing some wartime songs out of the blue, and people actually would join in. I joined in once when they were singing Katyusha, which, you know, is the version of my name. And also, you know, a famous song that every Soviet child knew, you know, and various other things. And so over the years, it has become a very kind of routinized, bureaucratized endeavor where state-supported enterprises, firms had to send a quota of their workers to that parade, and schools were started being required to send students with their ancestors' portraits. So it became this very bureaucratically organized and one-dimensional kind of parade, where basically people were pressed into the service of the war cult.
So it gets hijacked, right? It's yeah. too attractive of an opportunity. But your point is, even before that, it's not like you can commemorate this past, even if you object to the way it's being orchestrated from above. It's not like you're completely independent to commemorate this in any way you want. You're still a product of that culture. You still are subject to the mnemonic habituation, right? You've grown up in that culture. You've participated in the memory rituals. You've watched those films that you have a certain lens through which you see the past and you understand how you can commemorate it. And you're just reproducing a lot of that. So I think you try to underline how, aside from the fact of how the state takes advantage of the opportunity and creates its own organization, exploits this, even the original Immortal Regiment was reproducing a lot of the things from the Soviet era.
Yeah, I would call it the patriotic repertoire, right? And something that people have internalized. And so this is, yeah, exactly how mnemonic habituation becomes evident when people kind of fall back on familiar formulas and scenarios of patriotic self-sacrifice. And it kind of is evident in their rhetoric and sort of word choices in the way that they, despite the inclusiveness or professed inclusiveness, they still hold up this image of a soldier rising up from a trench, you know, to lead an attack.
It's a very masculine. It's a very male-centered, militaristic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's militaristic, very masculine, you know, doesn't worry about living or dying, right? It definitely kind of elevates that. And, you know, what was more disturbing, perhaps, is that over time, people started donning on replicas of military uniforms, of Red Army uniforms. And this was something that was considered not just an okay thing to do, but it was actually kind of amplifying your commitment to this ritual, right? And you could buy a forage cap that was sort of a traditional part of the attire, military attire, anywhere in Moscow. Yeah, everybody was wearing them, whether they were at the parade or not. You could see those forage caps on cashiers in like the subway or baristas handing you your expensive latte. And so I even bought one, I confess. So there was a kind of like a way in which people, through their bodily participation, signaled their agreement to insert their body into that patriotic scenario.
Okay. So if the way which we remember the past is shaped by the things that we internalize, whether it's a movie or whether it's participating in a commemorative march, you also point out that it works spatially, right? And there's been a lot happening within Russian cities over the past couple decades that taps into the Stalinist past. There's a whole landscape of memory that people are just subjected to that's all around them, where they're walking around, they're seeing a building, whether they're taking a subway, whether they're walking by some kiosk that's selling nesting eggs. There's a poster there. It's this insidious kind of backdrop to people's everyday lives that shapes how they understand the past. And it's almost, I can only relate to this through movies that there's so many movies that create this, a Matrix type of universe where, you know, you just internalize what you think visually is around you. How does this work? What are some of the elements of this celebration of the past, the Stalinist past that elevates Stalin, that elevates the memory of the victory in the Great Patriotic War? How is this just part of the landscape? And then you also point out how this works in conjunction with museums and exhibitions. They build on that. They amplify that. How does memory function spatially?
Right. Yes. So Stalin's images were mostly banned from public spaces in the wake of Khrushchev's de-Stalinization. So the years following 1956, when Khrushchev publicly condemned Stalin's personality cult, it was no longer acceptable to have Stalin statues. So his body was actually taken out of the mausoleum where he had been buried or displayed, mummified and displayed along with Lenin. So Stalin's body was moved and into a grave. A lot of his statues were demolished. There is a statue park in central Moscow that has one monument to Stalin as a kind of, it's not in any kind of public space. But at the same time, we see a gradual kind of exoneration of Stalin happening under Putin. That happens at a pretty alarming rate, and it's also not necessarily driven from above. There are local communities that erect statues to Stalin. You see Stalin-themed merchandise, right? And of course, at these parades of a mortal regimen, you see people carrying flags saying thank you to grandfather for the victory, and it has a Stalin in it. There are Stalin impersonators in tourist-heavy locations, especially in Moscow. So, and of course, there are also state-sponsored or state-sanctioned projects like historic restorations of subway stations in Moscow that were constructed in the first place to celebrate Stalin and his decisive leadership in the great victory. So Kurskaya station in Moscow, in the Moscow subway, for example, underwent a restoration in the aughts, and its sort of first version had Stalin's bust in a rotunda that was encircled by a patriotic lyric from the Stalin-era Soviet anthem. Stalin has reared up for sacrifice and labor, for labor and great deeds. But the idea was that, you know, podvig is a deed, a military deed. So that lyric was returned, and even though the Stalin bust was not, and it is something that is just there, right? People walk past it, it's not that conspicuous, but at the same time, it kind of sits there quietly. There have also been efforts to, like I said, bring out the memory of Stalin in the form of huge canvases from his lifetime to public exhibitions. And so it also happened this kind of under the guise of historic factuality, right? So here's something that celebrated Stalin as a leader, as a national leader, and we are going to bring it out in a kind of homage, right? So all of that de-Stalinization that happened after Khrushchev and was, you know, partially muted under Brezhnev, right? All of that has come back, and it's both explicit and kind of like, as you say, as a backdrop, and what I call ambient Stalinism. It's something that infiltrates our public spaces. And what's also interesting to me is how architecture started mimicking the style, the architectural style of the late Stalin era. Moscow is famous for its Stalin high-rises that are seven buildings that are very, very peculiar, and they're very tall too. So, and you can see them from any vantage point in central Moscow. So there's this whole building that is constructed in the aughts to look like one of the Stalin high-rises. And later on, they dedicate a statue to Kalashnikov, the inventor of the AK-47, right next to it. So to kind of cement the connection between that image of a military kind of the Russian brand, right, and this replica of a Stalin high-rise. And also in even popular imagination, the Stalin-era building, apartment building, is considered to be something of high quality. So those buildings were pretty solidly built. They had high ceilings. They had, some non-utilitarian features like decorations and so forth. So to buy a Stalin-era apartment is a kind of confers a certain kind of prestige upon you. And also newer apartment buildings have been built to mimic that style. And it kind of communicates on this very subtle level, right, that the aesthetic of late Stalinism is something that we embrace as an ideal, as a mark of quality, as a mark of prestige, of social status, right? And so to me, it is a very, it's a non-obvious, but nonetheless very pernicious way of habituating us to think of Stalin and the sort of the golden age of Stalinism as a time of plenty, as, make Russia great again kind of thing.
A lot of the things that happened kind of in the physical world, the cityscapes, the museum exhibitions, the commemorations, it really seems like you're going to a movie. You're up against all these forces that you're maybe not even aware of, whether they're orchestrated or whether they're just cultural products that draw you into that narrative of celebrating the war, that make it really hard, like a betrayal of your family, to challenge that or to devote attention to alternative memories, like of the repressions. And you finish your book with a chapter on archival memory. And you say, well, this is one space. It's a virtual space. Maybe in the virtual realm, there's a possibility for more independent memory. And even independently generated archival memories. You don't have to rely on the state. Maybe families can contribute their own memory. Maybe they can fill in the missing information. And you talk about a number of, well, you begin with a number of state-sponsored online archival projects. So the state is getting in on the act. It realizes this is an important way of influencing people. And then you have a couple independent initiatives to remember the repressions. So how does the state try to use the archival online source of memory to bolster its narrative of celebrating the Great Patriotic War and by tapping into the family in part? And what are how successful are alternatives to remembering the repressions? How easy is it for independent projects to shed light on the darker past of Soviet history?
I agree that the digital realm is probably more hospitable to alternative memories. And it is true that critical memory, especially commemoration and archiving of the facts of repression, has been more robust in the digital realm, because simply it's hard to keep track of these efforts. And also they could be housed on platforms that are not in Russia. So for instance, now, especially after the invasion of Ukraine in 22, a lot of these projects continue and, people can participate in them from any point in the world, really. That's kind of the beauty of digital commemoration, right? But yes, the Russian state has really put a lot of effort into digitizing military records, the documents that are available. So there could be death notices or missing in action notices. So there's been an effort to really count the dead, which I think is a laudable effort. But also like how the state has framed this effort is also interesting. So on the one hand, you can now find, a lot of people can find some kind of documentation of their loved one's fate. So whether it's, killed or missing in action, they can find sometimes the location where their ancestor was buried. And so this I think is a good thing. It's easily searchable databases that allow people to get access to that kind of information, which probably was not possible in the pre-digital era. However, the state is also framing it as a patriotic duty, as a project that demonstrates the same kind of, sacrificial nature of the Russian population, of the Soviet population, the way that the categories of the information are presented are highly suggestive of the sort of the patriotic indoctrination that they're trying to put it to use for. Again, it is the, and also how they shade the whole World War II experience to downplay other conflicts like the Finnish War that the Soviet Union was engaged in. And so, yeah, it's an interesting project. Also, how the state, especially in the database called Memorial, the very name of it is really an act of theft, because Memorial is usually associated with the name of the human rights organization that was started in the late 80s and whose purpose was to document the repressions, to create a database of names of those who were persecuted by the Soviet state, political prisoners especially. And so by taking this name, this war archive, war memory archive, is really trying to push the other one to the periphery. And in fact, in Russian online searches, the Red Army Memorial comes first. And of course, projects like the Immortal Regiment have created their own online database where families can contribute stories. And so this is kind of a bottom-up way of commemorating their loved ones. However, they give them a kind of like a format in which they can write the story. And the format is very suggestive of this kind of very militaristic path of your hero. So like the term hero, your soldier, your front fighter, and they're all nouns in Russian. Of course, we have gendered nouns that suggest the masculine, sort of the this was a male soldier who was a hero and was at the front line. So again, it kind of shapes the narrative, even if it's coming from the family of the soldier. And it is playing into the hands of the cult, the state-sponsored cults, by doing that, right? So it is formatting a very individual story into a pre-formatted narrative that is serviceable to the state. On the other hand, there have been several efforts to kind of display and augment the database of victims of repressions that was created by Memorial. And so Memorial, of course, is credited for its humongous effort to create this database of 3.2 million names. However, these these records are often incomplete. They lack a lot of information, like, for instance, the address of the person or where they were buried, right, or how they died. So there have been some efforts, some more independent efforts to create a family-driven commemoration where families would supply documents, photographs, and narratives to the existing record that could be, you know, could be gotten from the memorials database. So it's kind of an interesting effort, and there is always kind of this question: how do you arrange this? How do you tell the story in an online format? And I focus on or compare and contrast two projects that have been capitalizing on the memorials database, but in different ways. And one is a wiki style project that emphasizes kind of historical objectivity and the work of tending to irregularities in the record, trying to clean up the database when there are like repeat names or overlapping entries and so forth. And the other one is much more political and explicit effort. And it called itself the Immortal Barracks as a kind of explicit reference to the Immortal Regiment, where, you know, it was emphasizing that there's another side to the story of wartime, repressions, and the war, and trying to bring the significance of this project into the present rather than simply saying, okay, these are the people that were repressed, here are their names and biographies. So that project actually got sanctioned in a negative way by the state. And from what I understand, one of its editors was detained by the Russian authorities a year ago and had to flee the country. So it's a dangerous project. Even if you're doing something online, it doesn't mean that they can get to you if you're in the country. It's a precarious kind of project, and I think that I'm still hopeful that there are enough people who care about the memory of repressions and enough people who have the courage to do it both in Russia and abroad. When, you know, obviously for obvious reasons, Russia is the invader of Ukraine. It's the aggressor. Even people who have left Russia and are now living abroad and have anti-war positions, they still can be viewed with suspicions by, you know, residents of their host countries, because they are, you know, they're of Russia. You know, they cannot be fully divorced from that. So the book was finished largely before the beginning of the war in Ukraine, the full-scale invasion. And so I did add some reflections on what it means, what this cult means in the present day, in the context of the ongoing war, although I did not really go beyond the spring of 22. So interesting things have been happening domestically in Russia with the war cult, and that's another story.
Katya, thank you so much for taking your time today on your Sunday especially to talk to me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Katya Haskins is a professor of rhetoric and visual studies at Pennsylvania State University. I've been talking with her about her book, Remembering the War, Forgetting the Terror, Appeals to Family Memory in Putin's Russia. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. The best endorsement is word of mouth. I'm Rick Derderian. See you soon.